This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Michael K. Williams, has co-starred in two great HBO crime series, and now he's in a third. In The Wire, he was Omar, the fearless stick-up man who stole money from drug dealers. In Boardwalk Empire, he was Chalky White, a bootlegger who runs a nightclub in Atlantic City. In the new HBO series, The Night Of, he plays an inmate in Rikers Island, the notorious jail in New York City. The series, created by Steve Zalian and Richard Price, is about a young man, Nassim, or Nas, who makes a mistake of judgment and finds himself accused of murder and trapped in the criminal justice system. Nas is a college student living in Queens, New York, with his parents, who are immigrants from Pakistan. Nas's father is a taxi driver. One night when Nas wants to go to a party, he takes his father's cab without permission. A woman gets into the taxi in spite of Nas's protests that he's not on duty. He ends up going home with her, and when he wakes up in a drug stupor, he finds she's been stabbed to death. He seems to have no idea what happened, and neither do we. But the evidence appears to be stacked against him, and neither he nor his parents know how to navigate within the judicial system. Bail is denied, and he's sent to Rikers Island, where his prison block is controlled by an inmate named Freddie, played by Michael K. Williams. Freddie takes an interest in Nas and summons him to his cell.
You see, us and the guards, we all from the same hood. Some of us even grew up together. They know our families, we know theirs. But family's everything, right? It isn't a Muslim family.
Yeah.
I'll tell you something, man. See those brothers you pray with? The Nation of Islam? They're not your friends. In fact, they hate your ass because you're a natural-born Muslim. And they're just phony jailhouse opportunists looking for better food. Don't know the difference between Cairo, Egypt, or Cairo, Illinois.
I'm Pakistani, not Egyptian.
Yeah, well, my ancestors came from Doheny and not the Congo. Well, who gives a f, man? See, you're a celebrity in here. And I'm not talking a good kind. Dude kills four guys over some dope. Okay. But murder a girl? Rape a girl?
I didn't.
Doesn't matter. Makes no difference. See, there's a whole separate judicial system in here. And you've just been judged and juried. It didn't come out good for you.
Michael K. Williams, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I really like your performance in this series. What did you want to know about your character when you took the role?
You know, when I first got the part, it wasn't really nothing I wanted to know about him. I'm so familiar with people like Freddie, you know, from my childhood and from my personal life. You know, I have family members that remind me of Freddie, you know, just all this potential. All this raw potential that just got misguided and led to bad decisions, and those bad decisions came with consequences. I know that all too well, and so it wasn't something where I needed to do research to understand that world. I still visit my family that's incarcerated, and I see the good days, I see the bad days, I see the growth, I see what they lost by being incarcerated, and I saw the gains. I just dove into that.
You have family who's in jail now?
Yes. I have a nephew, Dominic DuPont, who I'm extremely proud of. If there were such a term as a model prisoner, he'd be the poster boy. You know, he went in at very early age. He defended his twin brother in a fight, and they got jumped, and a gun went off, and someone lost their life at the hands of my nephew. And I believe that had we had the proper money to hire the high-powered lawyers, his outcome probably would have been different. But, you know, did he do the crime? Yes. Did he do the time? Absolutely. But his record, what he's shown society, how he's grown in there, we're talking got his education, got married in there, managed to find a good woman and got married in there. he mentors young men that comes in behind him, whether it's an HIV/AIDS program or a Scared Straight program. While doing all of this, he still managed to keep his respect and his dignity. And as we all know, that's not easy to do in prison. You got to fight for your respect or you get run over. And he was able to ride that thin line.
So your character is in jail in Rikers Island, which is a very notorious jail in New York City. Did you know people in Rikers Island when you were growing up? Did you hear a lot of Rikers Island stories when you were growing up?
Yeah, D Block, yeah, House of Pain, a Four Main House of Pain. You know, and I just want to take a moment to just say, to give a shout out to all my brothers and sisters who maybe incarcerated on the island from New York City. Just keep your head up, man, and just keep striving to be the best you could be. You know, they can lock your body up, but they can't lock your mind up. Just keep striving. Tomorrow's a better day.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Michael K. Williams, and he's now one of the stars of the new HBO series, The Night Of. And now you have a new series on Viceland TV. That's the new Vice channel, and it's called Black Market. Will you go and report on underground markets, on black markets? And the first episode is about carjacking in Newark, New Jersey. You interview a minister, Reverend Ronald Christian, who ran the Christian Love Baptist Church, a church that bordered Newark in Irvington, New Jersey. And this was a church that was really important to you during a difficult period of your life. The episode is dedicated to the memory of this reverend. So in between the time that you recorded the interview and last November when he actually died, I don't know how much time elapsed, but you must have been really shocked. He was found dead on the floor of the church. Does anyone know what happened?
His heart just gave out, man. He got tired. You know, this was a man that, I've never seen someone give so much of themselves. 100% night and day. He just never stopped. He was always there in the community. If you're familiar with Essex County, and particularly Irvington and, you know, certain parts of the Oranges and especially Newark, you know that there's a lot of violence that goes on there, a lot of death. Life is very cheap on those streets. And he was always there.
What did he do for you? You came to him during a difficult part of your life. When I came around, I was broken.
I came through those doors, I was broken.
When was this?
This was, I would say, around the second, more like third season of The Wire. I was on drugs, basically, keeping it, long story short. And I was in jeopardy of destroying everything that I had worked so hard for. And I came in those doors and I met a man who had never even heard of The Wire, much less watched it. He was somewhere else in the Bronx preaching at another church when I first went there, and he stopped everything he was doing, ran back to New Jersey just because his team at the church told him that some guy named Omar was in trouble and needed to speak to him. And he came in his office, and he says, write your full name down and your email. He said, I'm going to go get you a Bible, man. You could keep that, and we're going to spend the rest of this day. And I was like, bet. So I wrote my full name down, Michael Kenneth Williams. And as he's leaving the office, he turns around and says, so what you want to be called, man? I said, well, my name is Michael, but, I could do Mike, He said, but why everybody saying Omar in trouble? And I was like, oh, this dude, that clueless. And had nothing to do with Hollywood light or who I was in my job. Some human being, just basic human being stuff. And he and I have been joined at the hip ever since. One of his biggest sayings was, I'm gonna love you till you learn to love yourself. And he never judged. He never, just nudged. Mike, if you want to stop this pain, I can help you with this. But until you're ready, man, I'm your brother. He never, I'm not saying he accepted me in my dysfunctionalism, but he loved me in it. And it worked for me. It got me to want to become a grown man, to grow up and to stop acting foolish, or at least to make the attempt to stop acting foolish,
Well, he had troubles in his own life. He had been a guard at a prison in New Jersey, in Newark. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then he started using drugs. And he ended up having to serve time in prison for stealing from the prison.
that he was working at. Talk about fall from grace, huh, T?
Yeah. And he even tells you in the episode that he learned to drive on a carjacked car. So he knew something about the kinds of problems people came to him with, because he had problems of his own. Did that help you, knowing that he had transformed his life? Was that like helpful as an example?
That was a huge help to me, you know, into not beating myself up so badly. It helped me to let go of the guilt and the shame of, you know, what I had done out there, what I was doing out there. Seeing him and to have him as an example of what it could be, it made my transition a lot smoother. He gave me a template, you know, basically, mm-hmm. like, okay, you know, and I'm not saying, I don't want to sound like I'm putting him up on a pedestal, you know, but it, you know, his message and the way he delivered the word, it was about no judgment. It was about the sin is not falling down. The sin is staying on the ground. You got to pick yourself up. We're going to make mistakes. We've made mistakes. There's going to be a few more we make before this ride is over. You make your apologies to whoever you may have, you know, and then you try to pick yourself up, take it one day at a time. And that was his message.
You interview a minister, Reverend Ronald Christian, who ran the Christian Love Baptist Church. And this is a church that was really important to you during a difficult period of your life. Was there a religious transformation in your life? Did that figure into your life at all?
Yeah, it was more of a spiritual awakening than anything religious. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the first time I actually walked into a church and felt like it's okay. I didn't feel dirty. You know, I come from a, you know, there's a lot of things in my past, some that I did, some that happened to me that you know, caused, you know, a lot of scars. You know, one was, you know, the molestation that went on in my life early on. I'm a survivor of that.
How old were you?
12 or 13, 12, somewhere up in there. You know, things happen.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, you move on and I never would go into church. I always felt like, you know, with the whole, it made me question myself on every level. You know, those events happening so early on in my life. And I would go to church with this, like, you know, this secret, this weight. Like, you know, I'm dirty. I'm dirty. God is never going to want me. I'm dirty, you know. You know, and then, you know, you mix that with the whole, you know, dark skin just became popular. I had a very low self-esteem coming up, and I just never felt like God loved me because I was dirty, because, you know, I was damaged goods for whatever reasons, whatever that means, you know. And I wore that badge very early on in my life, and I didn't let that go until I walked into Christian Love Baptist Church. You know, I saw other men who said, yeah, me too, out loud, you know. Yeah, and it doesn't make you less of a man. It doesn't make you dirty, you know. You know, how to forgive myself and how to forgive people and move on. I got all of that in Christian Love, you know.
Can I just ask, you know, when you were playing Omar on The Wire, Omar was gay. And I know that was challenging for you because you knew a lot of people who would be uncomfortable about you playing a gay man. And I think it was a little bit, you felt it was a little bit of a stretch too, but you did it. You did it excellently. You were the person who suggested the kiss when Omar first kisses his boyfriend on camera. You said, like, let's do it now. You basically wrote that in. But when you were 12 and you were molested, did that make you like question what your sexual orientation was? Like, what did that mean? And did that make you do you know what I mean? Did that make you unsure of yourself in ways that made you?
It definitely made me question, you know, why me, you know? So that type of stuff can, you know, mess with my head a little bit. You know, just those things you just did not talk about. You didn't talk about anything that made you feel sensitive or vulnerable. Those were not good character traits to have in my community. So here comes Omar, you know, and he is so, you know, external. He doesn't hide who he is. You know, he is like the quintessential underdog in, you know, in all senses of the word in my community. He's a dark-skinned, you know, openly gay black man who's not effeminate, who, you know, walks around openly with his boyfriend, doesn't care about fancy clothes, jewelry, doesn't use drugs, doesn't sell drugs, doesn't want to live in any fancy home. He just, anything that was deemed as eye candy in my community, you know, he rebuked all of that and was still deemed as respectable. You respected him, and you know, and that was like, just, you know, like a how do you do that? How do you make people respect you for being you in my community? How do you not conform to what, you know, society has made men in my community deem as being a man? You know, how did you make it cool to just be yourself in an oppressed situation, in an oppressed community? You know, it was just mind-boggling for me.
You know, in our first interview, you talked about how when you were playing Omar, it was hard for you to summon up the kind of power that he had. I mean, he was a stick-up man. He used to hold up drug dealers and steal their money. He didn't approve of drugs. He didn't like dealers. So he'd take their money and have no qualms about it. And he was tough enough and brave enough to do it. So you said that you never thought of yourself as having that kind of power. You know, in fact, the opposite. And so the thought of you playing that role made you laugh. And you even told me that in the first scenes that you played, you couldn't stop laughing because you thought it was so absurd for you to be
playing
somebody
memory
with that kind of power. So
it was the scene when we was walking down the aisle and Omar come and dropped the drugs out the window. He turns his back. I'm like, no one in their right mind who knows me, I said, it's over now. We're going to ruin this character because people are going to go out there. They're going to say, that's not real. We know Mike. Mike is not that. And it was like, you know, and so for me to connect, you know, again, the whole alpha male aspect, I don't know how to, but I don't know how to, I'm sorry.
I feel like maybe I understand a little bit more what you were saying. Like if you were molested, I could understand how you would feel like you didn't have that kind of physical power.
Yeah, I never felt like that. And, you know, I just wasn't raised to have that violent side. So it kind of...
Or to be physically intimidating.
Yeah.
You're laughing.
I don't have that.
Yeah, right.
I don't have that. It wasn't accepted in my mom's household to fight. That just was not the case. And, mm-hmm. and so I just didn't have that skill. But the anger, the emotions, I didn't know what to do with those when people would, you know, create those emotions in me. What do I do with that? So as a result, I ended up hurting myself a lot, you know. You know, a lot of my anger was turned inward on me. And this is where the drug addiction came from, basically.
So why do you think you started using drugs started using them again? I'm not sure which. After The Wire was on.
A little bit
after you'd become successful. Because you'd think on the surface that would be a period when your self-esteem would be, like, really good because you were so great in the role and people, like, loved you in it.
Yeah, see, that's the trick. It can't be anything outward that makes you feel good about yourself. That is the trick. Those things don't work. Feeling good, that's got to come. It's got to come from the inside out, not the outside in. And, you know,
Or you didn't feel worthy?
No, hell no, I didn't feel worthy of opportunity like that. And then, you know, when I was given this character as Omar, I could have used it as a nurturing tool for myself. It could have been cathartic for me. I decided to wear it as a Spider-Man suit, you know, and just fly around. Wee, look at me, I got web in my hands, you know. And instead of actually doing the work and finding out how I could, you know, use this character to make myself feel better about me, I used it instead of me. It was, it was like my crutch. And so when The Wire and the character of Omar ended, I had zero tools, personally speaking, in how to deal with letting that go. I wasn't going around robbing people or anything stupid like that, but I definitely wore that dark energy that Omar was. He was a dark soul, tortured soul, and I just woke all of that up and lived in that. So, and that's what people was attracted to. His whatever they were attracted to. I just didn't know how to differentiate okay, that is Omar's love, and then you have Michael's love. The lines got blurred. It was a little too close to the white meat at the time. It's old figure of speech in the streets. okay. When you cut somebody to the white meat. It was a little too close to home, that character, and I didn't equip myself with the tools of how to wash that off my psyche.
You know, we were talking about how you didn't feel powerful when you were young, and playing Omar felt like a real stretch for you, and you had this kind of dissonance between how you felt as a person and how you portrayed Omar. Something I know for sure that must have taken a lot of courage was when you were, I guess, in your 20s, when you decided to leave a job that you'd finally gotten with a pharmaceutical company to try to make it as a dancer, you know, and to try to have some kind of career as a performer. And I think, you know, that always takes a lot of courage to leave a secure job, even if it's not a job you especially like, and just kind of, you know, jump into the water not knowing if you'll float or not. So, you know, what was that like for you to decide, you know, you're going to do it?
You know, I was being a bit of a butt when I did that to my... That was the way to stick it to my family, especially my mom. You know, in my family, there are three things that you're taught to do. You either get an education, or you go into the military, or you get a trade with your hands. You know, the men in my family, that's what you do. And I kind of like failed at all three. So, you know, when I came out of the first program, for drugs. And so I went and got a job at Pfizer Pharmaceuticals. I was a temp job, and I worked there for a year. And they were about to make me a permanent when I saw this Janet Jackson video. And it was like, there was a combination of things that happened. One was my spirit got stirred by the visual images that were shown in that video, the black and white images, the strength, you know, and just like, you can see like these just different people, you know, some tall, some short, male, female, light skin, dark skin. It wasn't just this, everybody was pretty with perfect teeth. You saw some jagged edges in that formation in Rhythm Nation. Yet when they all came together, they moved like one. It's just the imagery mixed with the lyrics, and I'm a huge Janet Jackson fan. I couldn't run that fast. So it stirred my spirit. My spirit got awoken. My creative sources, energy got awoken the first time I saw that video. And it was a way to, like, you know, stick it to my mom's, like, yeah, I'm going to do it my way. I got on some Frank Sinatra, you know. I think I'm going to do it my way, you know what I mean? So it was a combination of, like, you know, I don't want to get an education. I don't want to get a trade. I don't want to go to the Army. I want to do this. I'm going to dance. You know, lo and behold, I got lucky. I started getting work. And that wasn't in the plans to actually, you know, become something. I just wanted to have fun and make a few dollars.
What kind of dancing had you done before?
Okay, now, when I say I used to be a dancer, I need you to know that I was a complete and utter hack. I have way too much respect for dancers and real choreographers to really call myself one. I just had a real good way with rhythm. I love movement. I love music. And I'm a good mimic. I can make it look like a pirouette, but when you really look at my form, any real dancer can tell you that's some garbage right there. So, you know, I was just that club kid in the clubs in New York City with his, you know, with his suspenders on backwards, the loud floral shirt, the baggy jeans, the high heel marshmallow shoes with the big platform, doing half splits in the club. I was that dude. And I got really blessed and was able to parlay it into a dance career, being at the right place at the right time and surrounding myself by the right people.
Let's talk about another turning point in your life. When you were 25, I think it was like the night of your 25th birthday, you got into a bar fight. That's when your face was slashed with a razor, and the scar that runs down the middle of your forehead, that's become almost like a signature. You know, it's almost like you're known for that. It's part of your look in a way, and you've managed to make it a strength instead of something horrible that you have to cover up that's going to hurt your career or anything like that. But when it happened, what did you think, assuming that you survived, because I think you were also cut in your throat that night?
Yeah, the second cut of that fight ends right at my jugular.
Uh-huh. Yeah. How did you think that scar on your forehead, which is visible, was going to affect your career as a performer?
I didn't think at all. You know, when I first got that that scar, when I jumped that night, I was just beginning my dance career, and I just got a gig as a model. There was this company called Rock Embassy that made tour jackets for various recording artists that went on tour, and they would sell them as merchandise. And I was one of the big spokesmodels for that company. And so I think it went in all the magazines, the hip hop magazines. It was like posters all in the subway stations, and that whole wave of press went out on November 20th or the 21st, and then I get this big slash down my face on the 22nd. So immediately I thought my modeling career was that. Well, that's over. Okay, we're gonna focus on the next thing on your resume. Dancing, yeah. Scratch model. Okay, now we're just a dancer. So you know. And I just want to say, man, there's some good advantages that came out of growing up in my community. That whole fake tough skin thing, it kind of worked in for me in this instance, because I refused to look at myself as a victim. I didn't go through the whole breakdown and oh my God, my life is over, and any type of shock and awe. I just put a couple of baseball caps in my face. I had that Bacitracin ointment in my bag to keep them stitches all moisturized, and I kept it moving. I didn't allow myself to feel weak over that incident, because I knew that mentally I didn't have what it would have taken to really deal with what had just happened. So I didn't mentally go there. They wanted me to seek therapy for trauma. I shut all of that down. I said, nah, I'm good.
What about the scar from your ear to your jugular? I don't think I've noticed that ever. Is that visible?
Because I purposely wear my beard. That's people, that's one of the reasons why I wear the beard, because it's gone down over the years. But if I turned my face to the right and showed you the side of my neck, you could see it. It's definitely there. And so I keep the beard. That's one of the reasons why I keep facial hair. It kind of just hides it back there.
Did you think you weren't going to make it through that night?
You know, I think, I think a lot of people thought that I wasn't going to make it to see 30. You know, my mom didn't think I was going to see 30, you know.
Does she watch your TV shows?
No, she liked Boardwalk Empire. I think she liked Happy Leonard a little bit. My mom has very peculiar taste. Like, one of her favorite things I've ever done is the R. Kelly videos, Trapped in the Closet. She liked that's like and shit. I think she watched Boardwalk Empire more for the Nucky character. I keep telling her, Steve, I think my mother has a crush on you. She just, every time that character would come on, she'd Nucky, Nucky. And I'm like, Ma.
Why don't we hear a scene from Boardwalk Empire?
Yeah.
And Boardwalk Empire was HBO's series set during the Prohibition era in Atlantic City. And Steve Buscemi played Nucky, who was the king of Atlantic City. Basically controlled politics, controlled the bootleg liquor. You play the most powerful African-American in the city, and you have a bootleg operation of your own, and then with Nucky's help, you run a very swank nightclub in Atlantic City. And so you've accumulated a lot of wealth. And in this scene, you're at a dinner party at your very well-appointed home with your wife and children. Your daughter's boyfriend, a medical student, is there too. And you're feeling very self-conscious because you're from the South, you're from the country, and he's very urban, he's educated, he's refined. There's a sumptuous duck dinner on the table. Your wife asks the medical student to say grace. You're a little drunk, and you keep interrupting him and talking about how they should all be eating Hoppin' John, rice and black-eyed peas. Here's that scene around the dinner table, and it starts with the boyfriend.
Lord, we...
Is that a duck?
Yes, Albert, of course it is. Please, Mr. Crawford.
Lord, we thank you.
I thought I asked for Hoppin' John.
There's duck. Peas, carrots, fresh baked biscuits.
I made chocolate pudding for dessert.
We'd like to thank you for
the... I asked a question.
Albert, please. She made that pudding all by herself.
It's very nice.
With a damn Hoppin' John.
Albert, you know that's not proper food for a guest. Now let's allow Samuel to finish.
Lord, we come together.
Maybe our guest would have liked some.
Well, I have always enjoyed that type of food, sir.
What type of food?
Well, my grandma would make it.
I said something funny, son.
Beg pardon?
You laughing? What's the joke?
Papa John's, Albert. You're being ridiculous.
I've been eating rice and beans all my life. Tell me it ain't good enough.
You'll have to forgive my husband's country ways.
I completely understand, ma'am.
It's my house! And my country ways put the food on this damn table!
Albert! You're drunk.
Sir, I apologize. I'll leave.
You stay right where you are, son. Right there. Inside the house. Pretty clear who the field nigga is.
That was Michael K. Williams as Albert Chucky White on Boardwalk Empire. So your character in Boardwalk Empire is from the South, from the country. You're very urban. You're from Brooklyn. What did you feel like you had to learn about the South and about Prohibition era to play Chucky White?
Well, you know, Terry, there wasn't nothing I had to learn about the South. I'm first generation Bahamian from my mother's, but my father is straight from a small town in South Carolina called Greeleyville. So I have full working knowledge of the South. What Boardwalk and portraying Chucky White did for me was it gave me time with my dad, who's no longer here again, but not in this time frame. It allowed me to go back and hang out with him in his childhood, what he went through with coming up as a man. Him and my uncle Jehu, my uncle Parr, my godfather Junior, my uncle Tommy, all these men are deceased, and Chucky White gave me time to hang out with them in their era when they were young men coming up. That's what they all went through. That's what they lived in.
So both in The Wire and Boardwalk Empire, your characters are shot to death. In The Wire, you're shot by a kid. Mm-hmm. And Boardwalk Empire, it's almost like a firing squad. And it's like, you know, there's like, I don't know, five gangsters who just kind of line up and shoot you. And you die off camera. It kind of fades to black. Can I ask you what it's like to experience your character's death?
Oh, wow. That's a first. That is a first time I've ever been asked that question. Well, with The Wire, we've covered that. That was a very jagged pill to swallow. Didn't do well with that one. Chalky was a releasing. You know, I let go. I just released. When he closes his eyes and says, you know, nothing real anyway. It did. You know, I went somewhere personally. It was a release.
Mm-hmm.
I left Boardwalk feeling lighter, as I should, feeling in myself, in my mind, in my skin, feeling lighter, like I had left some things there, you know, and I felt that my ancestors were proud of me. I walked off that set with my chest held high because I gave it my best shot. I did the best I could, and I was around the best, some of the best talent this business has to offer. But, you know, so those what those two deaths felt like for me. They were complete polar opposites from what I got from them. You know, now, having said, you mentioned who they got shot by, a black teen on the streets of Baltimore. Chucky White got shot by a firing squad, you know, ironically, of all black men in Harlem. And it speaks to what's happening today, you know, in our society. And so those images that you see on The Wire and Chucky and in Boardwalk Empire, and particularly with my character's demise, I don't take that lightly, you know. And anybody that was on the set that day when Idris Elba and I had to shoot the scene where Stringer Bell dies, I was shaking like a leaf and crying, you know, because I did not want to do that. It just didn't feel right. Like, how do you come to these two dark-skinned, strong-minded black men, strong-willed black men, as we say in the hood, these two kings, how is it always they got to come, you know, and as a face off and one of them got to die? You know, I didn't want to be a part of that. I didn't know at that point. I questioned what am I doing? Am I telling the truth or am I perpetuating the problem? I suffered with that on the wire, you know, and that weighed on me. And even though it's fake, where I go in my psyche, it, trust me, it is very real.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes equipped with all those emotions that comes from having killed someone that looks like you. You know, how do you mm-hmm. deal with that? Where do you go with that? That's where I take it.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, when you started on The Wire, you weren't very experienced as an actor. You'd had small roles,
man.
Including a small role on The Sopranos. You'd been in videos, but you hadn't had a major part like that, and, you know, a recurring part in a major series. By the time you did Boardwalk Empire, you were much more experienced, and now you've just done The Night Of, and you're even more experienced. What are some of the ways your approach to acting has changed between The Wire and now when you're such a more experienced actor?
One of the main things that's changed from when I was first on The Wire and to now, and particularly the Night Of, is I know how to differentiate myself from the character. You know, I still go in just as deep, but now I have the tools, which was not the case during The Wire days. I had the tools in which how to pull myself out of that. You know, it starts, number one, with prayer and meditation. You know, you got to wash that off your psyche. You got to wash your brain, man. You got to cleanse yourself. I don't play fictional characters, you know, where, you know, where you can't look hard enough and fight. There's never been a character that I haven't played where someone says, I know a guy just like that. So that's my lane. And so I honor that. I give thanks to the chance to be given the opportunity to tell someone's story and to have someone feel like they give someone something to identify with. I take pride in that and I take gratitude in that. So that begins the process to let me remind myself, Mike, it's not about you. You know, you've been given a job. You have a vessel in which you get to touch people through your art. That's a blessing. You know, I'm very humble to be living this life and to have this job, but I have to protect myself. I got to take care of my vessel, and it's a spiritual, mental, and physical thing constantly.
It's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much, and thank you for all the great work you've done.
Thank you, Terry. Thanks for your time.
Michael K. Williams co-stars in the new HBO series, The Night Of, and he hosts the new Viceland series, Black Market. After we take a short break, Ken Tucker will review the new album by Maxwell. This is Fresh Air.